1972, Joey Gallo killed in Little Italy during dinner at Umberto's Clam House.
An hour from now, be it tonight, or 100 years from now, I'm in jail. I mean, I was
They get there by violence, and often as not, they leave by violence.
Between $3 and $5 million in cash and valuables was taken from the Lufthansa cargo terminal out at Kennedy Airport.
I can give you guys $500,000 a year without a problem.
New York City is a war zone for mobsters and their targets.
Hello, everyone, and welcome into episode 48 of The Black Hand, an organized crime history podcast. I'm your host, Bliss Grieve, and on today's show, we're going to be talking about Manuel Noriega, a Panamanian dictator, politician, and military officer who was the de facto ruler of Panama from 1983 to 89. More than that, however, Noriega amassed a personal fortune through drug trafficking operations and even traded arms on behalf of the U.S. during the Iran-Contra affair, granting him long-standing ties to the United States, who consistently supported his illicit operations before the U.S. invasion of Panama removed him from power. Before we get started, if you want to support the show, please rate it and go follow the show's Instagram and Twitter pages at The Black Hand Pod, and please feel free to reach out. Also, consider giving a little bit to the show's Venmo at The Black Hand Pod as well. The link's in the description. But without further ado, let's get right into today's episode. Manuel Antonio Noriega Moreno was born on February 11th, 1934 in Panama City, to a relatively poor mixed-race family with native Panamanian, African, and Spanish heritage. Noriega's mother, who wasn't married to his father, has been described as a cook and a laundress, while his father was an accountant. However, Noriega would have to deal with some real hardship pretty early on in life. His mother died of tuberculosis when he was still a child, and Noriega was brought up by his godmother, and by the time he was 5 years old, both of his parents had died. As he came of age, he was educated at a well-regarded high school in Panama City that had produced a number of nationalist political leaders. During his time in high school, he even met his older half-brother, Luis Carlos Noriega Hurtado, a social activist and student at the school, for the first time. Regardless, Manuel started living with Luis, who introduced him to politics, including recruiting him into the Socialist Party's youth wing. During his time in the Socialist Youth Group, Manuel took part in protests and wrote articles criticizing the U.S. presence in Panama. But it was also around this time that Noriega is reported to have begun his association with U.S. intelligence services, providing information about the activities of his own associates within the Socialist Party. In the meantime, he graduated to become a doctor, but was unable to secure a place in the University of Panama's medical school. He was instead able to win a scholarship to Corrijos Military School in 1958 in the Peruvian capital of Lima with the help of his brother Luis, who had by then received a position in the Panamanian Embassy in Peru. While there, he became close with a man named Roberto Diaz Herrera, who was studying at the Peruvian Police Academy at the time and later became a close ally. He graduated by 1962 with a specialization in engineering, at which point he returned to his home country and joined the Panama National Guard. That same year, he was posted to the city of Colón and commissioned as a second lieutenant. His commanding officer was a man named Omar Torrijos, then a major in the National Guard and eventually the military leader of Panama. He became a mentor to Noriega, and in 1962, he even helped Noriega avoid legal trouble after a prostitute accused Noriega of assaulting her. But despite Noriega's problem, Torrijos maintained their relationship, ensuring that they were always in the same command. He also brought Roberto Diaz Herrera into the same unit, and while he and Noriega became friends again, they would also become rivals for Torrijos' favor. Then, in 1964, Noriega was posted to the province of Chiriqui, where Torrijos and Herrera were stationed. At the time, a native of the province, named Arnulfo Arias, was preparing to contest the 1968 Panamanian presidential election. Arias was a member of the Nationalist Revolutionary Party that represented the Panamanista movement. while the sitting president, Roberto Chieri, belonged to the Liberal Party, which ordered Torrijos and Herrera to harass Arias' party and weaken his election bid. Torrijos eventually passed this task on to Noriega, whose men arrested a number of people, several of which later reported that they had been tortured. This mistreatment of Arias supporters sparked public outrage and led to Noriega being suspended for 10 days, an item of information that was picked up by U.S. intelligence services. Then, in 1966, after another alleged sexual assault, Torrijos had Noriega transferred to a remote posting. As a second lieutenant, he spent months taking courses at the School of the Americas, located at the U.S. Army's Fort Gulick in the Panama Canal Zone. It has been suggested that Torrijos sent Noriega to the school to help him shape up and start meeting expectations. And despite performing poorly in his classes, he received a promotion to first lieutenant in 1966, and Torrijos found him a job as an intelligence officer in the North Zone of the National Guard. But not long after, he had to return to the school once again for more training. At the school, he participated in courses on infantry operations, counterintelligence, and jungle warfare. He even took a course in psychological operations at Fort Bragg in North Carolina. Noriega's job forced him to penetrate and disrupt the trade unions that had formed the United Fruit Company's workforce, and he proved adept at his work. His new superior boss, Boris Martinez, was a fervent anti-communist and enforced strict discipline on Noriega. However, reports have suggested that he continued to pass intelligence to the U.S. during this period. In 1967, the administration of U.S. President Lyndon B. Johnson concluded that Noriega would be a valuable asset as he was a rising star in the Panamanian military, but he was about to run into some problems. Because Arnulfo Arias was elected president in 1968 following a populist campaign, and soon after taking office, he launched a purge of the National Guard, sending most of its general staff into diplomatic exile or retirement. In response, Torrijos and a few other officers led a coup against him, ousting Arias as the leader of the presidency. The coup was set in motion by Boris Martinez as the leader of the garrison at Chiriqui and received the support of most military officers. A power struggle followed between the various forces involved in the coup and chiefly between the Torrijos and Martinez groups. However, Noriega remained an important supporter of Torrijos during the conflict. In February 1969, Torrijos' men seized Martinez and exiled him to Miami, giving Torrijos control of the entire country. Then, at the end of 1969, when Torrijos went to Mexico on holiday, a coup was launched in his absence, in which Noriega's loyalty allowed Torrijos to hang on to power, greatly enhancing his image. Within a month, Noriega was promoted to captain, and just 18 months after that, in August 1970, Torrijos promoted him to the position of lieutenant colonel and appointed him chief of military intelligence. And when Arias supporters launched a guerrilla uprising in his home province, Noriega, as the head of intelligence, played an important role in putting it down within a year. Torrijos retained his power as a military ruler until 1981. During this time, he negotiated the Torrijos-Carter treaties with U.S. President Jimmy Carter, which ensured that control over the Panama Canal would pass to Panama in 1999. These treaties, as well as a new labor code that included maternity leave, collective bargaining rights, and bonus pay, made Torrijos popular in Panama despite the absence of democratic elections. Throughout his reign, his relationship with Noriega remained symbiotic. Torrijos provided the political acumen, while Noriega enforced his unpopular decisions with force when necessary. Noriega would even provide intelligence and carry out covert operations that were critical to Torrijos successfully negotiating the release of the Panama Canal from the U.S. But upon seizing power in 1968, Torrijos' government had passed legislation favorable to foreign corporations, including banks in the U.S. The following years saw a large expansion in international business activity and the influx of foreign capital, thereby giving particular cooperations a stake in the continued existence of the military government. The government also used its foreign capital to borrow extensively, fueling a rapid expansion of the state bureaucracy that contributed to the military regime's stability. Panama's borrowing peaked in 1978 when the Panama Treaty was being negotiated, in which the Carter government was particularly supportive of the Torrijos regime. The Carter administration's interest in signing a new treaty led it to largely overlook the increasing militarization of the Panamanian government and its involvement in drug trafficking. And throughout this time, Noriega proved to be a very capable head of intelligence. During his tenure, he exiled 1,300 Panamanians whom he viewed as threats to the government and also kept files on several officials within the military, the government, and the judiciary, allowing him to blackmail them later on. Noriega also held the positions of head of the political police and head of immigration, and it's probably no surprise that his tenure was marked by intimidation and harassment of opposing parties and their leaders. He was even described as doing much of Torrijos' dirty work. For instance, Noriega ordered the death of Jesus Hector Gallego Herrera, a priest whose work at an agricultural cooperative was seen as a threat by the government. Gallego's body is reported to have been thrown from a helicopter into the sea. He also made an effort during this period to portray Panama as a hub of enforcement against drug smuggling, possibly as a result of pressure from Torrijos. Despite that, by the early 1970s, American law enforcement officials had reports of Noriega's possible involvement with narcotics trafficking. But no formal investigation was launched and no indictment was brought, likely due to potential diplomatic consequences. This evidence included the testimony of an arrested boat courier and of a drug smuggler arrested in New York. And though Torrijos frequently promised the U.S. cooperation in dealing with drug smuggling, Noriega would have headed any effort at enforcement, and the U.S. began to see Noriega as an obstacle to combating drug smuggling. It's even alleged that the U.S. government considered several options to move Noriega out of the drug trafficking business, including assassinating him and linking him to a fictional plot against Torrijos. And though no assassination attempt was made, the other ploys may have been tried in the early 1970s. However, beginning in 1972, the U.S. relaxed its efforts at trapping individuals involved with smuggling within the Panama government, possibly as a result of an agreement between Torrijos and U.S. President Richard Nixon. As a result, during the early 1970s, Noriega's relationship with U.S. intelligence services was regularized. The CIA placed him on its payroll in 1971 while he held his position as head of Panamanian intelligence, as opposed to being paid by the CIA on a case-by-case basis like before. Regular payments to him were stopped under the Carter administration before being resumed and later stopped again under the administration of Ronald Reagan. The CIA valued him as an asset because he was willing to provide information about the Cuban government and later about the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. Noriega also served as the U.S. emissary to Cuba during negotiations following the Johnny Express incident in December 1971. He was given access to CIA contingency funds as high as $100,000 in some years, which he was supposed to use to improve his intelligence programs, but he was able to spend it with little accountability. But that was in spite of the fact that the CIA was aware that Noriega was selling intelligence on the US to Cuba while he was working for it. He also undertook a number of activities while nominally working for the CIA that served his own ends at the expense of the US government. It's even alleged that he was linked to a series of bombings targeting the U.S. territory in the Panama Canal Zone during the prelude to the U.S. presidential election in 1976. After the administration of U.S. President Gerald Ford stepped back from negotiations about the Panama Canal, the bombings highlighted to the U.S. government the difficulty of holding on to the Panama Canal Zone in the face of hostility within Panama. Despite that, in a December 1976 meeting with George H.W. Bush, then Director of Central Intelligence, Noriega flatly denied involvement, instead suggesting that the CIA was responsible. However, things were about to take an eventful turn for Noriega. After the Nicaraguan Revolution was launched by the Sandinistas against the U.S.-backed authoritarian ruler named Anastasio Somoza Debay in August 1978, Treehouse and Noriega initially supported the rebels, providing them with surplus National Guard equipment and allowing Panama to be used as a cover for arms shipments from Cuba to Nicaragua. But before long, Treehouse sought the same aura of quote-unquote democratic respectability that the Sandinista rebels had in Nicaragua. So he abandoned the title of maximum leader that he had taken in 1972, promising that elections would be held in 1984. For his part, Noriega arranged for weapons purchased in the U.S. to be shipped to the Sandinista forces, a deal which netted him a decent profit. No charges were brought against him because the U.S. didn't want to anger a friendly country. And the issue was largely drowned out following the Sandinista victory in 1979. After Somoza's overthrow, Noriega continued to smuggle weapons, selling them to leftist guerrillas fighting the U.S.-backed authoritarian government in El Salvador. But after one of these shipments was captured, Treehouse, who had friends in the Salvadoran military government, reprimanded Noriega, though the shipments didn't stop altogether. Then, on July 31, 1981, Treehouse died in a plane crash. In a later investigation by the aircraft manufacturer stated that it was an accident, Noriega's authority over the government led to speculation about his involvement. And while a man named Florencio Flores Aguilar had inherited Treehouse's position, the true power lay with the trio of Noriega, Roberto Diaz Herrera, and Ruben Dario Paredes, who ranked just below him. Flores was removed in a quiet coup on March 3, 1982, by general agreement, and Paredes was made Panama's military leader until 1983, after which the military would work together to ensure his election as the president in the election scheduled for 1984. And during this period, Noriega became a full colonel and the National Guard's chief of staff, effectively the second highest rank in the country. In this position, he reformed the National Guard as the Panama Defense Forces, or PDF, and with the financial assistance of the U.S., expanded and modernized it. Then, on August 12, 1983, in keeping with Noriega's earlier deal with Paredes, Paredes handed over his position to Noriega, a newly appointed general, with the understanding that Noriega would allow him to stand for president. However, Paredes never received the political support he expected, and after assuming his new position, Noriega reneged on the deal, telling Paredes that he couldn't contest the new election. As a result, Noriega, now head of the Panama Defense Forces, really became the de facto leader of the entire country. But he preferred to remain behind the scenes rather than become president, and to avoid the public scrutiny that came with the post. He didn't have a particular social or economic ideology and used military nationalism to unify his supporters. The Democratic Revolutionary Party, which had been established by Treehouse and had strong support among military allies, was used by Noriega as a political front for the PDF. This party drew considerable support from low-income employees brought into the government bureaucracy by its expansion under Treehouse and Noriega. Noriega even compelled the Panamanian National Assembly to pass Law 20 of 1983, which was supposedly aimed at protecting the Panama Canal from communists and allowed a huge influx of U.S. weapons to the Panamanian military. The law also tripled the size of the military forces. However, Noriega's period in power saw significant capital flight from Panama, likely in part because wealthy individuals worried that their wealth would be seized by Noriega's administration. The military government of Treehouse was only able to maintain their power by extracting resources from Panama's expanding service sector, specifically its illicit portions. So when Noriega created the PDF in 1983, he brought into its control Panama's customs and immigration apparatus, as well as the country's entire transportation network. This expansion of the military's role occurred simultaneously with a large growth in the cocaine trade, as well as in markets for weapons in various military conflicts in Central America. and the profits that the military reaped from these activities gave Noriega's military regime considerable financial clout. He took control of most major newspapers by either buying a controlling stake in them or forcing them to shut down. The government also harassed, intimidated, or exiled individual journalist editors. Despite this, he kept face for the public, and in May 1984, Noriega allowed the first presidential elections in 16 years. But even with the supposed show of democracy, Noriega continued pulling the strings behind the scenes as he and Roberto Diaz Herrera picked a man named Nicolas Ardito Barletta to become the PRD's candidate with the intention of keeping him under close control. So when the initial results showed that Arnulfo Arias, who had the support of most of the opposition, was on his way to a landslide victory, Noriega halted the count. And after brazenly manipulating the results, the government announced that Barletta had won by a slim margin of 1,700 votes. Independent estimates have suggested that Arias would have won by as many as 50,000 votes had the election been conducted fairly, which checks out, as more than 60,000 votes weren't included in the final count. And after this faux election, Noriega's rule became increasingly repressive, even as the US government, led by Ronald Reagan at the time, began relying on him in its covert efforts to undermine Nicaragua's Sandinista government. The US accepted Barletta's election and signaled a willingness to cooperate with him, despite being aware of the flaws in the election process. So it's probably no surprise that between 1981 and 87, the relationship between Noriega and the US grew considerably. It was driven both by the US's pursuit of its security interests and Noriega using these as an effective means of gaining favor. It all started with the emergence of internal conflicts in Nicaragua and El Salvador between 1979 and 81, which left the Reagan administration looking for allies in the region. Noriega acted as a conduit for US support, including funds and weapons, to the Contra rebels in Nicaragua. He allowed the CIA to establish listening posts in Panama and also helped the US-backed Salvadoran government against the leftist Salvadoran insurgent group known as the Farabundo Marti National Liberation Front. US spy ships used bases in Panama in their operations against the Nicaraguan government, and much of the intelligence gathered by these ships was processed in the US bases in Panama. Noriega permitted these activities, despite the Panama Canal treaties restricting the use of the US bases to protect the canal. George H.W. Bush, now US Vice President, met again with Noriega in December 1983 to discuss support for the Contras. Noriega had a working relationship with U.S. Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North by 1985, and he offered to assassinate or sabotage Sandinista leaders in return for North helping Noriega improve his image with the U.S. government. Then, in June 1985, North met with Noriega in Panama, and Noriega agreed to train Contra soldiers in Panama for an invasion of Nicaragua in 1986. In return, Panama's support for the US and Israeli efforts to supply the Contras with arms, the US ignored Noriega's use of weapons shipment networks to smuggle drugs into the US. Noriega was reported to have even played a role in the Iran-Contra affair in the mid-1980s, which would see senior Reagan administration officials facilitate the sale of arms to Iran, which was under an arms embargo at the time, to fund the Contras with the proceeds. There are varying reports about how much Noriega was paid by United States sources. It's been claimed that the US gave Noriega, or his intelligence services, annual payments in the range of $110,000 in 1976, increasing to nearly $200,000 when he came to power during the Reagan administration. Though the source claimed he couldn't find anyone willing to confirm persistent reports that Noriega received a $200,000 a year stipend from the CIA. But despite his alliance with the US, he also maintained close relationships with bitter enemies of the US, including Cuba, Libya, and even Nicaragua. A 1990 book discussing Noriega's administration stated that he had sold thousands of Panamanian passports to the Cuban government for use by its intelligence services. Cuba also obtained hardware imports from Panama that were restricted by the U.S. embargo, while it provided Panama with weapons and military advisors. Libya, as well as some U.S. allies, even provided Noriega with funds when the U.S. was seeking to remove him from power. But he didn't need the money for now, because Panama's and Noriega's involvement in drug trafficking grew considerably through the early 1980s, peaking in 1984. Intensifying conflicts in Colombia, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua had led to the creation of covert transportation networks that Noriega used to transport drugs to the U.S., particularly cocaine. During this period, Colombia's Medellin cartel was also seeking allies, and before long, Noriega became intimately involved with their drug trafficking and money laundering operations, and received considerable sums as protection money, bribes, or shares of profits. And by June 1986, an investigative journalist recorded a U.S. White House official as saying that reducing Noriega's activities could greatly reduce international drug trafficking as a whole. He also reported unnamed U.S. officials as saying that Noriega had amassed a personal fortune in European banks as a result of his illegal activities, as well as owning 2 homes in Panama and 1 in France. The wealth generated for the Panamanian military from drug smuggling also helped stabilize the authoritarian government that it dominated. However, the military's control over wealth from the illicit drug trade alienated the Panamanian business elite that had previously benefited from such trade. Under Noriega, these profits were shared within the military less evenly than under Torrijos, eventually creating friction in the military leadership. Large sums from drug revenues were brought in from Miami and elsewhere to Panama for laundering, and Noriega received protection payments in these instances as well. An American named Stephen Kalish also began a large-scale business selling drugs, laundering money, and selling hardware to the Panamanian military for considerable profits with Noriega's assistance. And at the time of the 1984 election, Kalish was preparing to ship a load of marijuana worth $1.4 million through Panama, for which Noriega had agreed to provide false Panamanian customs stamps. For this effort, Noriega was paid $1 million. Beginning in 1984, Noriega appeared to begin reducing the scale of his operations and even ordered a raid against a cocaine factory in the interior of Panama, a raid which he then emphasized as evidence of his cooperation with the U.S. in their fight against drugs. He also ordered a crackdown on money laundering by Colombian cartel figures like Jorge Ochoa and Gilberto Rodriguez Orejuela. Noriega's new image as an opponent of drug trafficking was symbolized by his being invited as a speaker in 1985 to Harvard University for a conference on the role of the military in Central America's wars, a speech that received a lot of attention in Panama's pro-government press. Then, in 1986, a convoluted operation involving the East German Stasi and a Danish ship ultimately aimed to sell Soviet arms and military vehicles to South Africa's arms corps, with the Soviets using various intermediaries to distance themselves from the deal. Hugo Spadafora was a physician and political activist who had first clashed with Noriega when they were both members of the Torrijos government. Despite not being a member of the opposition, he became a vocal critic of Noriega after returning to Panama from Guatemala in 1981. Spadafora amassed evidence of corruption within the government by using his position as an ally of Torrijos to question Noriega's allies. And in September 1985, he accused Noriega of having connections to drug trafficking and announced his intent to expose him. The drug trafficking charges threatened Noriega's support among his own constituency of middle-class individuals who had benefited under his and Torrijos' government. It's been reported that on an occasion, when Spadafora was traveling by bus from Costa Rica to Panama, witnesses saw him being detained by the PDF after crossing the border. His decapitated body was later found wrapped in a USPS mailbag, showing signs of brutal torture. Noriega was widely believed to be responsible for the murder, and the U.S. allegedly had intelligence implicating him. But rather than helping, Spadafora's murder badly damaged Noriega's image, both within and outside Panama, and created a crisis for the Panamanian regime. President Barletta, who was in New York City when Spadafore was murdered in September 1985, announced his intention to appoint an independent commission to investigate the murder. Upon his return to Panama, however, he was forced to resign by the PDF and was replaced by Vice President Eric Arturo de Valle. Barletta was highly respected in the Reagan administration, and his removal brought a downturn in the relations between the U.S. and Noriega. After Spadafore's murder, the U.S. began to view Noriega as a liability rather than an asset, despite his ongoing support for U.S. interventions elsewhere. The U.S. response included reducing economic assistance and pressuring Panama to reduce its banking secrecy laws, crack down on narcotics trafficking, investigate the murder of Spadafore, and reduce the PDF's role in the government. And the response to Spadafore's murder created divisions within the PRD and further damaged the credibility of the government-controlled news media. Roberto Diaz Herrera tried using the uproar around Spadafore to seize power during a brief period that Noriega was traveling outside the country, but despite mobilizing some troops, he eventually decided against following through with the coup, realizing that he couldn't count on sufficient support. Furthermore, Noriega had made a deal with his deputy to the effect that he would step down as military leader in 1987 and allow Diaz Herrera to succeed him. In 1987, however, Noriega went back on this agreement, announced he would be heading the military for the next 5 years, and assigned Diaz Herrera to a diplomatic post. Diaz Herrera retaliated by making public statements accusing Noriega of rigging the 1984 election, murdering Spadafore, and of trafficking in drugs, as well as assassinating Torrijos with a bomb on his plane. These statements provoked huge protests against Noriega, with 100,000 people, around a quarter of the population of Panama City, marching in protest on June 26, 1987. As with Spadafore's murder, these incidents strengthened and brought together the internal opposition to Noriega. So Noriega charged Diaz Herrera with treason and cracked down on the protesters. The U.S. Senate passed a resolution asking Noriega to step down until Diaz Herrera could be tried. In response, Noriega sent government workers to protest outside the U.S. Embassy, a protest that quickly turned into a riot. As a result, the U.S. suspended all military assistance to Panama, and the CIA stopped paying Noriega a salary. But the Senate resolution had the effect of identifying the U.S. with the effort to remove Noriega from power, and he exploited the rising anti-American sentiment to strengthen his own position. However, without the support of the U.S., Panama defaulted on its international... However, without the support of the U.S., Panama defaulted on its international debt, and that year, the country's economy shrank by 20%. And though the U.S. considered not recognizing Del Valle as president, the State Department decided against it, as it would have amounted to breaking relations with Noriega. Noriega's relationship with the U.S. deteriorated further during the late 1980s, particularly after the U.S. began to suspect that he was supporting other intelligence services. They even suspected that he was selling intelligence to the Cuban government of Fidel Castro. So multiple U.S. agencies continued to investigate Noriega despite opposition from the Reagan administration. And in 1988, he was indicted by U.S. federal grand juries in courts in Miami and Tampa on charges of drug trafficking. The indictment accused him of, quote, turning Panama into a shipping platform for South American cocaine that was destined for the U.S., allowing drug proceeds to be hidden in Panamanian banks. Despite this, Noriega was about to try and fix yet another election. But the presidential election of May 1989 in Panama was marred by fraud and violence. The Coalition for National Liberation, a pro-military coalition led by a former business partner of Noriega as its candidate. The Democratic Alliance of Civic Opposition nominated Guillermo Endara, a member of Arnulfo Arias' Panamanista Party, and two other prominent oppositionists named Ricardo Arias Calderon and Guillermo Ford as vice presidential candidates. Anticipating fraud, the opposition tracked ballot counts at local precincts on the day of the election. And as an exit poll made it clear that the opposition was winning by a wide margin, reports of missing tally sheets and seizure of ballot boxes by the PDF soon emerged. In the aftermath of the day after the election, the Catholic Bishops' Conference announced that a quick count of public tallies at polling centers showed the opposition winning 3-1. But official tallies the day after had Noriega's candidate winning by a 2-1 margin. Rather than publish the results, Noriega voided the election, claiming that foreign interference had tainted the results. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, present in Panama as an observer, denounced Noriega, saying that the election had been stolen, as did the country's archbishop. And though Noriega had initially planned to declare his candidate the winner, he knew he had been defeated badly and refused to go along. The next day, Endara, Arias Calderon, and Ford rolled through the old part of the capital in a triumphant motorcade, only to be intercepted by a detachment of Noriega's paramilitary, the Dignity Battalions. Arias Calderon was protected by a couple of troops, but Endara and Ford were badly beaten, and images of Ford running to safety with his shirt covered in blood were broadcast around the world. And when the 1984-89 presidential term expired, Noriega named a longtime associate of his, Francisco Rodriguez, acting president. But the U.S. recognized Endara as the new president, and Noriega's decision to void the election results led to another coup attempt against him in October 1989. And after he weathered it, he declared himself the maximum leader of the country. The rebels were captured and taken to a military base outside Panama City, where they were tortured and then executed. And in March 1988, the U.S. government entered into negotiations with Noriega seeking his resignation. Then, on December 15, 1989, the PRD-dominated legislature spoke of a state war between the United States and Panama. It also declared Noriega chief executive officer of the government, finalizing a state of affairs that had existed for 6 years. The government stated that Noriega's forces were harassing U.S. troops and civilians. Three incidents occurred in particular very near the time of the Panama invasion and were mentioned by Bush as a reason for the invasion. In a December 16, 1989 incident, four U.S. personnel were stopped at a roadblock outside the PDF headquarters in the El Carrillo neighborhood of Panama City. The United States Department of Defense said that the servicemen were traveling unarmed in a private vehicle and that they attempted to flee the scene only after their vehicle was surrounded by a crowd of civilians and PDF troops. First Lieutenant Robert Paz of the United States Marine Corps was shot and killed in the incident, while an American couple who witnessed the incident was also arrested and harassed by the PDF. The U.S. launched its invasion of Panama on December 20, 1989, and although the killing of the Marine was the ostensible reason for the invasion, the operation had been planned for months before his death. The move was the largest military action by the U.S. since the Vietnam War, and included more than 27,000 soldiers as well as 300 aircraft. The invasion began with a bombing campaign that targeted Noriega's private vehicles and the PDF headquarters located in Panama City. Several slums in the middle of the city were destroyed as a result. Noriega's deputy colonel retreated with some soldiers to the mountains outside David City after laying mines in the airport. And though this was part of the contingency plan for the invasion, the colonel decided that the Panamanian military was not in a position to fight a guerrilla war against the U.S. and negotiated a surrender. 23 U.S. soldiers were killed in the operation, including two that were killed by friendly fire, and 324 soldiers were injured. And while the casualties among the Panamanian forces were much higher, between 300 and 845, the toll it took on Panama's communities was much worse. The U.S. government reported between 202 and 250 civilian deaths, while America's Watch estimated 300 civilian deaths, and the United Nations put the total around 500. As a result, on December 29, 1989, the United States General Assembly voted 75-20 with 40 abstentions to condemn the invasion as a, quote, flagrant violation of international law. And though Noriega received several warnings about the invasion from individuals within his government, he didn't believe them, But as they grew more frequent, as the invasion drew near, he was eventually convinced to go on the run. He used several methods of deceit, including lookalikes and playbacks of his recorded voice, to confuse U.S. surveillance as to his whereabouts. The last 2 days of his flight were spent partly with his ally, Jorge Krupnik, an arms dealer that was also wanted by the U.S. Noriega also considered seeking sanctuary in the Cuban or Nicaraguan embassies, but both buildings were surrounded by U.S. troops. On the fifth day of the invasion, Noriega and four others took sanctuary in the Holy See's embassy in Panama. And though he had threatened to flee to the countryside and lead guerrilla warfare if not given refuge, he instead turned over the majority of his weapons and requested sanctuary from an archbishop. Prevented by treaty from invading the Holy See's embassy, U.S. soldiers from Delta Force erected a perimeter around the area where Noriega was. Attempts to get Noriega to surrender from within included gunning vehicle engines, turning a nearby field into a landing pad for helicopters, and playing rock music at loud volumes. And after just 10 days, Noriega surrendered on January 3, 1990, and he was detained as a prisoner of war and later taken to the United States. The trial was delayed until September 1991 due to whether Noriega could be tried after his detention as a prisoner of war, the admissibility of evidence and witnesses, and how to pay for his legal defense. The trial ended in April 1992 when Noriega was convicted on 8 of the 10 charges of drug trafficking, racketeering, and money laundering, and just 2 months later, he was sentenced to 40 years in prison. Though it was later dropped to 17 for good behavior, and it ended in September 2007. But his legal troubles were nowhere near over yet, as his criminal trial in the U.S. was just the start. Noriega was tried in absentia in Panama for crimes committed during his rule, and in October 1993, he and two others were convicted of the murder of Spadafora and sentenced to 20 years in prison. In 1994, he and an agent of his secret police were convicted of the murder of Moises Giraldi, who had led the 1989 coup attempt against Noriega. And finally, Noriega received a third 20-year sentence in 1996 for his role in the death of 9 military officers who supported Giraldi. The group had been executed in a hangar at the Albrook Air Base after the coup attempt in an incident that came to be known as the Massacre of Albrook. Then, the French government requested Noriega's extradition after he was convicted of money laundering in 1999. It was stated that Noriega had laundered $3 million in drug proceeds by purchasing luxury apartments in Paris, and he was convicted in absentia. He was later convicted in a jury trial on July 7, 2010, and was sentenced to 7 years in prison. And a little over a year later, he was extradited back to Panama to serve his sentences, totaling 60 years. Then on February 5, 2012, Noriega was moved to a hospital in Panama City due to high blood pressure and a brain hemorrhage, later being diagnosed with a brain tumor. On January 23, 2017, he was released from prison under house arrest to prepare for a surgery that would remove the tumor. However, on March 7th, he suffered a brain hemorrhage during surgery, which left him in critical condition, and he died just 3 weeks later on May 29th, 2017, at the age of 83. But that's really all I have for you guys today. I hope you all thoroughly enjoyed today's show, and tune back in next week for episode 49. If you enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating and follow the show's Instagram and Twitter pages at The Black Hand Pod. And feel free to reach out with feedback, suggestions, and comments. Also, please consider giving a little bit to the show's Venmo at The Black Hand Pod as well. But with that said, I hope you all have a great rest of your day. This is your host, Bliss Grieve, signing out.